Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Democrat Natasha Marcus spent 3 terms, 6 years, as a state senator in the North Carolina General Assembly, representing Mecklenburg District 41. But the shape and makeup of that district changed each time she ran. And so in this last election, almost assured of a defeat due to gerrymandering, she ran for state insurance commissioner. She lost to Republican incumbent Mike Causey by less than 5 percentage points. Since the last election was a mixture of a lot of losses and some wins for Democrats here and around the country, we thought it would be interesting to spend this hour with Senator Marcus to get her thoughts on the future of the Democratic Party, on the future of politics in a highly divided country, the role Democrats can and should play during a Trump administration nationally and at a time when they broke the GOP supermajority in the legislature, along with many more topics as well. Senator Natasha Marcus, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for the invitation. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Let's start with gerrymandering, or at least the drawing of legislative districts that led to your district being redrawn each time you ran for office. We know that the legislature has been redrawing districts ever since the 2020 census, maybe the 2010 census. And each time Republicans have attempted to do what Democrats did before them, redraw the districts to favor their party, only they have more sophisticated tools, thanks to emerging technology, than the Democrats did in their heyday. The size and shape of your district changes wildly if you look back at the maps each time. And you say that this time it was blatantly rigged. Your words. Would the Republicans who drew the map agree, or would they simply say it was redrawn in a way that makes more sense?
Well, that would depend on if you ask them in private or on the radio. If you ask them in private, they would admit that they did what they did to eliminate me from the Senate. I know that because I talked to them about it. They tried to do it to me the cycle before and drew a map that would have, much like it does now, put me in an unwinnable district by dividing up the town of Davidson, where I live, and adding that to an Iredell County district instead of a Mecklenburg County district like I've always represented. And they gave me the opportunity to save myself, is how they said it, if I would agree to their gerrymandered map. It was very gerrymandered in other ways all across the state, in unfair ways that give them an advantage they did not earn at the ballot box, that does not reflect our state. And they were willing to put me back in Mecklenburg County and save my seat if I would vote for their gerrymandered map. They desperately wanted some Democrats to vote for their map so that they would be more likely to win in court. They knew they would get sued. I was unwilling to make that deal with them because I believe gerrymandering is wrong, and I'm not going to vote for a map that is that blatantly gerrymandered, even if it meant losing my own seat to make that point. I think they were shocked when I would not take that deal, and that made them even more angry. So when they got a chance again 2 years later, we have the map we have now, which made it impossible for me to win and to stay in the Senate. That was before a single vote was taken. They decided, based on how they wanted to draw that map, that Senator Marcus is out. And now they knew that the courts would support them, so they didn't offer a deal. They didn't have to offer a deal. They have control of the courts and knew that the court would rubber stamp their map, which it did. And so they know what they did. I know what they did. They may not want to admit that. They can say, oh, it makes more sense. But we all know what happened.
You know, it sounds awful. It sounds undemocratic. Perhaps it is. But the Democrats did this to a lesser degree. And maybe that's not the right word. The Democrats did this when they were in charge of the legislature. They did this to Republicans. No question about it. And Democrats in power in other democratically controlled states around the country do the same thing right now. But the Democrats in North Carolina did not have the technological tools that allowed them to do this with surgical precision, as was brought out in one of these court cases that the Republicans have today. Why does this go on? This is
The problem is that in North Carolina, as in most states, legislators are required by the Constitution to draw the very maps on which we then have to run.
Is that accurate?
Senator,
is that accurate? Are legislators required to do it, or are the states required
yes,
to do it?
Yes, that's why there would have to be a constitutional amendment, most scholars believe, in order for us not to have to draw the maps. And that's a problem, because there is always a desire to get more advantage for yourself, for your own party, if you can, right? It is baked into the system that we have. That's why I signed a pledge the very first term I was elected to say, I support nonpartisan redistricting, but that legislators should not be doing this work because it is inherently fraught, too political. And I wanted to be on the record so that if and when, I hope it does happen sometime, it didn't happen while I was there, but if and when Democrats do regain control of the state legislature, that I would be on record supporting nonpartisan redistricting, because it's always going to have to be the party in power that agrees to be the bigger person and do the right thing for democracy and give up the ability to draw the map so that we no longer try to benefit ourselves, our friends, our party, and instead do what's right for democracy and the voters and give everybody an equal voice. So I signed that pledge. I filed several bills that included ways in which we could reform our redistricting system. Those bills never got a single hearing. I held press conferences about them everywhere I went when I was both in the Senate and when I ran statewide. So many people said to me, why do we have to put up with this redistricting? And it is, I will say, you're right, Mike, it happens in other states, but North Carolina is the poster child for extreme gerrymandering. They redraw the districts not just once a decade, the way they're supposed to under the Constitution after a new census, but every 2 years. And now they control the state court, which rubber stamps whatever they do. There's no checks left in place. They tinker with it every 2 years to make themselves even a little more advantaged, a little more advantaged, a little more advantaged. They're not supposed to do that. It's supposed to be once a decade, and they are making a mockery of that by how they've been running things.
When you first ran in 2018, just to give folks, and this is difficult to do on the radio because we have no visuals, but to give folks an idea of what your district looked like in 2018, it ran from the top of Mecklenburg County all the way down the left side of Mecklenburg County to the bottom of the county, and it included portions, I think, at
Pineville,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Then it was drawn two more times to take up various different portions of the northern part of the county in 2020 and 2022. And at one point, you had constituents, as you said, in Pineville, and then you didn't. And you had constituents in Steel Creek, and then you didn't. And this year, they shrunk your district. They took out, I think, Cornelius and half of Davidson. And they draw, as you said, they drew a line right down the middle of Davidson. Did that put you in the wrong district to live in, to run for the district you were representing, or am I wrong?
Right.
About
so
that?
Where my house is, they actually split my precinct in half. Davidson only has two precincts. And the precinct that I'm in, they actually split it in half. You're not supposed to split a precinct unless absolutely necessary. That's supposed to be the smallest section that's of neighborhoods that stay together. But they know where my house is, and so they just split it in half, made sure my house was on the wrong side of that line, and put my house along with another part of Davidson within Iredell County district. So it's all of Iredell County, part of Davidson, and part of Cornelius. It doesn't make any sense. But again, it was to their advantage to do that, because now my house, you have to live in the, unlike congressional districts, for a legislative race in North Carolina, you must live in the district that you seek to represent, and you must live there for a year before the election. So I had approximately a week and a half from when those maps came out to if I wanted to stay in the Senate in the district that was at least close to the one I represent now, that would have given me a chance to run again. I would have had to sell my house and move in a week and a half.
Not
And
possible.
I was unwilling to let them control my life to that extent.
And you would be moving into a district that leans Republican by a margin of 62 to 35%. So
No,
you
if
would
I
have lost.
stayed, I'd be in a
Oh,
district that was
okay.
that. That's
Right.
where my house is now. So I'm going to be represented by a Republican senator now going
Right.
forward because my part of Davidson is in a red district.
So this happens under Democrats, it happens under Republicans, it happens all over the country, and it happens because the Supreme Court has said that political gerrymandering is legal, but racial gerrymandering is not. And sometimes the two overlap. But why? Why would the court, who's supposed to be upholding democracy, believe that political gerrymandering is okay?
You're asking me to explain why the U.S. Supreme Court does what it does. I can't explain that to you other than to say it's very clear they don't want to get involved in the partisan fights. I think it's wrong for democracy. There's some big problems with our democracy, and one of them is the extent to which gerrymandering is used to make voters feel like their vote doesn't matter. Because things are decided before they ever get to the
Right.
polls.
Because the politicians are choosing their voters, not the other way around. So what is the
Absolutely. It
impact?
is
What is
turned
the
upside
impact
down.
of that?
Well, voters feel apathetic because, like I said, they, and just to use myself as an example, so many voters appreciate the work I've been doing. I got elected three times by pretty good margins. I would have stayed in the Senate and continued to represent my constituents, but for gerrymandering. So those same constituents now are not given a choice. Now we're forced into a Republican district. Our new senator is the almost the exact opposite of what I have been fighting for, and voters have no choice about that. So it makes people less likely to bother to vote. And when they do vote, feel they're the things are rigged, that it didn't matter that they voted because the outcome was decided before a single vote was taken. That's bad for democracy. It's unfair. It makes
Well, let me.
people feel like politics and politicians are working on their own behalf more so than the people they're supposed to be representing.
You have said that just because the legislators can do it doesn't mean they should. And the politicians, it's clear, the politicians who are drawing these maps know precisely what they are doing, as they told you behind the scenes, and as they have admitted in public. I
Oh,
think one legislator said that he deliberately drew the map, at least the one of the maps, not the legislative map necessarily, but maybe the congressional map, deliberately to make sure that Republicans had more seats. And he would have made it even worse if he could have figured out how, but he
yeah.
couldn't figure out. I'm
Right.
paraphrasing here. So they carve out their own voters, which begs the question, do these people believe in democracy, or is it merely a power grab?
In North Carolina, which is what I know, Republicans would not have total control of the state legislature unless they used these tricks to rig the map. They know that, and we know that. So they have to do this because if they don't, they lose their power. Phil Berger, who runs this state, he's the most powerful person in the state, as far as I'm concerned. He had to himself redraw his own district this time to make sure he stayed where he was because he's got such unchecked power that people in his district were really mad and ended up emailing Democrats like me. I don't represent Summerfield, but they knew that that their senator's unanswerable to them. It's bad for democracy when one party has so much power.
We're going to talk about what it was like, about what it was like to be in the minority party for your entire time in the legislature when we come back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Senator Natasha Marcus, who for 6 years, three terms, represented Mecklenburg District 41 as a Democrat in the state legislature. She ran in November to be the state insurance commissioner and lost by a hair. We're going to talk about that and more with the senator who joins us for the hour. This is kind of the exit interview, I guess. So Republicans have been in charge of the legislature since, I think, 2010, 2011. That means that you have been a member of the minority party in the legislature during your entire time in that body. Talk about what that's like. Does it make it worth getting up in the morning?
It's a good way of asking it. I've had so many trips. I have been trying to add it up, driving back and forth to Raleigh, often at odd hours in heavy traffic. And it's a tough job. You have to live in the district, so here in Mecklenburg County, but you have to show up to work in Raleigh every week, pretty much year round, pretty much every week. And so I do sometimes ask myself that as I'm driving yet again to Raleigh to do what feels like banging my head up against a brick wall. Is it worth it? Why do I do this? we're getting ready to fight a fight that we will probably lose once again. Is it worth it? And here's what I believe, and this is what I remind myself when I do that. There are a lot of people who voted for me who want me to go there and say what needs to be said. So when they are trying to pass an abortion ban, or they are picking on LGBTQ kids, or they are funding private school vouchers instead of public education, that's wrong. All those things are wrong. And that we need people in that body who are willing to stand up and say it. And I am proud to be one of only 50 people in the whole state who get to have a seat in that chamber. And yes, I'm part of the minority, but I do have a voice. And what I say becomes part of the public record, and it matters. And so I am proud to have been the spokesperson for my constituents for all these years, and a lot of people who are represented by someone that doesn't speak for them as well. And so I've done the work for 6 years, proudly so, for very little pay.
People should know what they pay our state senators.
I love playing that game. When I go to a group, I say, just guess, what do you think a state senator gets paid? What do you think my salary is? And I just love to, every time it starts at about, oh, probably what, 70,000? And I say, oh, way too high. And they say, too high? Really? I say, oh, yeah, keep going until we get them down to the $13,800. That is the correct answer. And people are just shocked to know how little we pay.
Please tell me they give you a car allowance or they pay your gasoline.
They pay, they reimburse for one trip a week at half of the federal approved rate for mileage. So no car allowance. I think it covers our gas at half of the reimbursed rate, and we get $104 a day. When we're in session, that is supposed to cover our lodging and our food while we are away from home.
Which, so, of course, it does not. It might have in 1960. At both the national and state levels, we have three constitutionally mandated branches of government. At the national level, Donald Trump and his cronies have been working together to strengthen the power of the presidency, and Congress has, by default, voluntarily taken the role of lapdog. In North Carolina, Republicans in the General Assembly have been actively working for years to weaken the power of the executive branch, that of the governor and the Council of State. And just last week, they voted to weaken it further, taking additional powers away from incoming Governor Josh Stein and even incoming Democratic Attorney General Jeff Jackson and others. Is this about Republican versus Democrat, the legislature, or the legislature versus the other branches of government? In other words, would they have taken these actions had Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson won the gubernatorial position?
It is definitely about concentrating power with Phil Berger and his friends. Again, he is the most powerful person already in this state because he's been the President pro tem of the Senate for so many years. And what he wants happens in our state. And he is always looking for ways to solidify that power. So they do it with gerrymandering, his district and the districts of his friends. They do it with money that they get from very powerful lobbying groups that they dole out to the people they want to win. And they do it with these unconstitutional bills to grab more power for themselves. You ask whether they would do it if it wasn't about Republican versus Democrat. Of course they wouldn't have done it if those elections for council state races had gone the other way. I mean, just as the most blatant example, we are now going to be the only state in the nation that has the state auditor run elections. It makes no sense to put it in the hands of Dave Bullock, who just got elected for the first time to anything to be state auditor, and now he's supposed to run our elections. Why did they pick him? Because he was one of the few Republicans who won a council of state seat. And they want to also be in charge, make our elections even more partisan. So Phil Berger and his friends can have a thumb on the scales and be more in control of that aspect of government as well. It is blatant, it's undemocratic, and it is as obvious as can be why they're doing it.
I want to point out to folks who may not know you well, Natasha Marcus, that you have politics in your blood. Your father was a leader of the Republican Party and a New York General Assembly member for years. At what point, and clearly we all learn about politics from our elders as we grow up, at what point did you become a Democrat and why?
Yeah, some of the Republican legislators I serve with thought I was kidding when I told them that I grew up a Republican and was in college. So it was after college when I like to say when I started really thinking for myself about as a young professional woman and feeling more and more, I believe the Republican Party changed. My dad, I want to point out, was always a pro-choice Republican. He had two daughters and a wife, and he thought we should have equal rights to control our bodies and make big decisions, like when to have a child. So his brand of being a Republican faded to the point now where it's non-existent. And so the party changed, but also I moved to the South. I came down here to go to law school in the early 90s. It's the first time I'd lived in the South, and it became very clear to me when it was Jesse Helms or Harvey Gantt. That race was happening at the time, and I thought, whoa, wait a minute. This Jesse Helms guy does not represent my values at all. It was a pretty quick evolution at that point. Going to law school, you know, you learn about the three branches of government, like you talked about, Mike, and how important that is. And then where are my values? And so I am, since that time, been very clear that Republicans have some good ideas, but even people like my father could never vote for Trump or that version of politics. Feel very strongly that as a woman, especially, the Democratic Party represents my values.
Well, there's no question that the Republican Party is not your father's Republican Party. It has changed substantially and continues to do so. And some would argue that it's not the Republican Party anymore. It's the Trump Party, which is a very different animal. And he is neither conservative nor Republican. Some would say that. But others say that the Democratic Party has also changed substantially and has morphed into something unrecognizable for longtime Democrats. Would you disagree with that?
I mean, everyone is entitled to their opinion, I suppose. I feel like the values of the Democratic Party are to be on the side of working families, to have a fair tax code, to support public education, first and foremost, because it is the great equalizer. To acknowledge the equality and humanity of every person, not just the people in your own party or who follow your faith or who love the way you love. So to me, that's not extreme at all. And when people say that the Democratic Party has gone too far or whatever, I just think that they are not actually familiar with what we fight for, at least here in North Carolina. I don't think a single thing that we fight for is extreme.
Whose fault is that? Senator, whose fault is the fact that people don't know what the Democrats stand for or what the Democrats have done. It was clear in this last election, either they didn't believe what Joe Biden's administration did, or they didn't experience what Joe Biden's administration has allegedly done to impact the economy in a positive way. And our economy is the envy of the world at the moment. Nobody has it better than we do. We may not like where we are, but nobody has it better than we do. But the Democrats have, for a long time, had a problem with messaging and getting all the troops on the same message point, which the Republicans are supremely good at. Why don't people give the Democrats credit, or are they giving them credit and don't like what they see?
I think that economic policies are complicated. It's hard to message in a 10-second blurb on a commercial. It's true that we've experienced inflation under the Biden administration. It's an offshoot of saving our economy from a recession, but people don't think that far back enough to analyze it. That's part of the problem. Another part of the problem, at least in our state, I've noticed that people don't even know who their legislators are. They don't know who represents them in Raleigh. They don't know what they're doing or saying or voting for or why. There's very little coverage of that. It may be people are disinterested. I don't believe they're disinterested, but folks just don't know. They don't understand. They don't know who Phil Berger is and how powerful he is and what he pushes for. Casinos, massive casinos, is his answer to our problems. Most people don't support that, but they don't know that that's what's on the horizon. They don't know that we're facing a structural budget deficit because of things like income tax reductions. Sound great. Everyone would prefer to pay less in taxes, but not if it's going to mean we have to lay off all the teacher assistants in the whole state. And we're going to fund private school vouchers for millionaires. I think people just don't understand what the Republican Party's about. And as far as falling in line, I see it every day in the North Carolina Senate. Members of the Republican Party are okay with that authoritarian leadership. Phil Berger tells them how to vote, and they do it every time. Every Republican senator always votes yes on every bill that comes before us. Why? Because they've decided privately in caucus, this is a bill we want to go through. Phil Berger's given it his blessing. Therefore, we're bringing it up for a vote. They never bring up a single bill for a vote that they don't want to pass. So you know if it's on the calendar, it's going to pass. And they all always vote yes.
Let's talk about vouchers for a second. you mentioned that these vouchers may make a serious dent in our funds, in the budget. And we have, at the moment, I don't remember the number exactly, but I think it's in the billions, isn't it? A surplus? That would all go away under this voucher program?
Again, this is where economics gets complicated. These are some of the facts that cause myself and many public education advocates great concern about this voucher money. And let's be clear, the most recent round of voucher money is to fund part of the private school tuition for families that are earning an unlimited amount of income. So the very top tiers of our income, so millionaires plus, who are already sending their kids to private school and paying for it just fine, have never even tried public school in many cases. That's who we're funding with private school vouchers between the 2025 and the 2031 school year. Our state will have to spend at least over $5.8 billion cumulatively to fund these vouchers, private school vouchers, that are going to go to these, again, some of the wealthiest families in our state, when we are clearly not funding public education the way we should. We are losing teachers, veteran teachers who know their craft, and we have crumbling schools structures, some with lead in the water still, and instead, the number one priority, it seems, they called a special session to pass this voucher bill, is to give private, it's welfare for the wealthy that we cannot afford.
So let's go back to the beginnings of this, because the public schools allegedly in North Carolina have been underfunded for decades. The Leandro decision that's still in the courts, I think after two decades, which said, yes, you underfund them and you must fund them to X level. And they don't do it because they just have ignored the court somehow. Right. The legislature has allowed more charter schools to open, the funding for which comes from public schools. Now, as you say, they have voted to expand these opportunity scholarships, these vouchers, to all students, regardless of income or financial need. And they're sending the money directly to these students to use it for private school education, some of which will be taking place in religious schools. None have the same operational oversight that the public schools have. There's no accountability at these schools. Is this what Republicans say it is? Is it an expansion of parental options to give parents the opportunity to take their children out of failing public schools? Not all schools are failing, but some don't do a good job and they have no options. But this gives them that option. Or is it another step in a plan to destroy public education?
It seems clear and clearer to me that they are doing what they want to do to undermine public education. As I just explained, these vouchers are going to the wealthiest families who are already sending their kids to private school. So it's not providing a choice that they don't otherwise have. That's ridiculous. Those families can send their kids to private school, and that's fine. No one's ever said that they can't. The question is whether we want to take money away from public education to help them out a little bit.
Because that's my question. Is that what they want to do?
Apparently, that is their priority. They have ignored the Leandro court order for decades, like you said. They don't want to fund public education.
So I have less than a minute left in this segment, but behind the scenes, what's the scuttlebutt? What are you hearing? Do they talk about the reasons they're doing this, or do they pose it even behind the scenes as a positive?
They would never admit that they're trying to undermine public education. Well, maybe some of them would. Some of them think public schools are where the devil resides, I suppose. But this is within their value set to say, we want to encourage families to send their kids to Christian schools that are funded with state money, I think in violation of separation of church and state, because that's what they prefer.
So I want to get to that because that's an important aspect of this. And this is taxpayer dollars that are being used for this. And not all taxpayers would agree with any of this, or some of it, or some would agree with all of it, but not all of them. We'll talk about that when we come back with Senator Natasha Marcus from Mecklenburg District 41. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is State Senator Natasha Marcus, who's a Democrat who for the last 6 years has represented District 41 in Mecklenburg County. But she will be exiting from that role as the legislature changed because she opted to run for insurance commissioner because she was gerrymandered out of her home district, but lost that race, which we'll talk about later on. We're talking about spending some time on school vouchers here. And you have said, and I think rightly so, that these vouchers, because there's no income level set for these, anybody can get these, even if you make $300 million a year and your children are already in public school, private schools, and they can afford to pay the full freight and more, they can afford to buy the school, they will get these vouchers. Okay, that sounds unfair on the face of it because it's coming from taxpayers' money. But on the other hand, they say that it's fair because low-income children caught in some failing public schools will now have an opportunity to have the same opportunities as these wealthy individuals. Problem is, it seems to me, is that these opportunity scholarships will not pay the full freight of a private school education in many instances. And there's no guarantee that the private school will take your child because they have the option to say no to that child. Is what's going to happen here, is the fallout likely to be that the poorest among us, the blackest and brownest among us, are going to end up in the public schools, which will be even more underfunded because as they have a desertion rate of students going to private schools, they won't get the funding level that they're accustomed to.
That is exactly where we're headed, and that is what has happened in the past. So many of the private schools that are going to be benefiting from these vouchers, I call them, they call them opportunity scholarships, but they are vouchers for private school, were founded literally as segregation academies during the time when here in North Carolina and across the South, there was forced integration of schools. White wealthy families did not want their children to have to go to school with Black children. And they created these very schools that are still doing business today as a way to escape that.
Well, ProPublica reported on that, but that just because they were founded for that purpose does not mean that they are operating today under that same purpose.
Would that be true? Their stated purpose now. You're correct. Okay. And that is a great, I encourage your listeners to read that. It's a long report from ProPublica. I cited it on the Senate floor the day we debated these vouchers. But the effect is still there, that who is going to these fancy, most expensive private schools now funded with public money? It's the wealthy, and it is in many cases white students. The demographics of the schools, they looked into that, slant very much toward a lack of diversity, I'll put it that way. And I will point out that of all 50 states, North Carolina currently ranks fourth lowest for per pupil spending in public schools and second to last in its effort to fund public education relative to our state's wealth. Second to last for our public school funding.
So yes or no, it is still true that these private schools can continue to be selective about who they accept.
Absolutely.
Correct?
If your parents are gay, they can turn you away. If you have a learning disability of any kind, they can turn you away for that. If you don't subscribe to their version of, it's in most cases Christianity, they're mostly Christian schools, although there's one that's an Islamic school. If you don't follow their faith, they can turn you away. Many reasons why they can discriminate and cherry pick who they want to
and
come
will
to
we school. And will we ever know those reasons? In other words, do they have to reveal that information either to the parents or to anybody?
ProPublica was able to get a lot of that data, but it is not clear to me that it's required. Very little reporting is required from these public or these private schools, even though they take public money, about how the students are doing, for example. What do they teach? Many do not follow any kind of set state curriculum. They don't have to teach that evolution is scientific fact, for example. They can just teach a Bible-based view of creationism and call that science. And again, we, the taxpayers of North Carolina, are funding that. Those schools have always existed, and no one is saying that they can't exist and that parents can choose to send their children there if they want that kind of education for their child. I think it'd be a mistake, but this is America, and you can choose that if you want. But it is a whole different deal to say we are going to fund those schools with public money to the detriment of our public schools that have a lot of checks and balances in place to make sure that's an education based on facts and science,
despite
preparing kids for the bigger world.
Despite many people on the right saying otherwise, this is not a Christian nation. It was not founded to be one. The concept of the separation of church and state is in the Constitution. Yet, as you say, some of the voucher money is going to religious schools. And you pointed out in your speech on the Senate floor, and you've alluded to it here, that some teach strictly from the Bible with very conservative interpretations. Some go so far as to say that men shall be leaders, not women. And people, of course, are free to agree or disagree with that point of view. And even being taught. But these, as you say, are taxpayer dollars. Is there any way to know whether North Carolina taxpayers, North Carolina voters, agree with these opportunity scholarships? because of this fact, or would it matter if they didn't agree? Because it's done.
Well, practically, it doesn't matter. It's passed. Democrats voted no. The governor vetoed it. But because there's a supermajority right now by Republicans, they just overrode the veto. I think some Republican members were getting a little bit uncomfortable themselves with this idea because they come from areas of our state, the more rural areas of our state, where there are no private schools, or maybe there's only one in the whole county that can even use these private school vouchers, but yet they're going to lose money from their public school coffers to fund it. There are many more of them in urban areas like Mecklenburg County that will benefit. So I was waiting to see if any Republicans would break ranks, and as I told you, always happens, they all voted yes. So there doesn't seem to be a willingness to push back ever on the agenda that Phil Berger and the leadership in the legislature set. And they said they wanted this to pass, so it passed.
We put a lot of pressure on public schools to do things that have nothing to do with education, and we hold them to standards that are checked out by constant testing, which people have complained ad nauseum about. But these schools, charter schools, private schools, operate under a completely different standard. Some would say no standards at all, and they don't.
Can I correct a little bit on that? Charter
sure.
schools are public schools. You do not pay tuition to go, and they have to follow the state curriculum and pass the same tests that a traditional public school does. So we have to be careful to not okay. lump charter schools in. That's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about private schools,
private schools.
Of them religious-based private schools that don't have any or very few checks and no transparency, no rules about what they have to teach. Teachers don't have to be certified. They don't have to pass standardized tests of any kind in these private schools. So that's a big distinction okay. that sometimes gets blurred. So I wanted to make that point.
So I'm glad you did. I stand corrected on that. I'm glad you did. But these private schools, as you say, don't have any, there's no accountability. Well, now that we are funding them as taxpayers through these vouchers, do we not have a right to demand that the teachers be certified and they can prove that, that demand that the curriculum is up to state standards, demand that they are performing at a level that is bringing these students some sort of success? Do we not have that right?
I argue that we do have that right. It's very unusual for the General Assembly to give away billions of dollars with zero strings attached. No need to check in on how that money's being spent. And yet—
So why are they doing it?
That's what they do on private school vouchers. They love them
yes,
so
but
much.
Why? Why?
They don't want to. I think if one of them was here, they would say, well, these are private schools for a reason. We don't want to turn them into public schools. We want them to be able to teach what their faith leads them to teach. And the only check we need is that parents want to send their kids there. And as long as parents want to send their kids there, we're going to keep funding it. The problem with that, of course, is kids come out of some of these schools unprepared for college or any bigger world whatsoever. They're one of the schools that took in the most voucher money a few years back was found to have embezzled a lot of the money. And there, because there are so few checks, no one even noticed for years. So there's a huge problem with giveaways of massive amounts. And now it is ballooned into, again, being in the billions of dollars from our state revenue with no strings attached and no accountability. I don't understand why they're okay with that when they're clearly not okay with that when it comes to public schools where right. there's all kinds of checks.
And before we move on, since this is going to cost a substantial amount of money in 5 years or so, although it's almost, they've sold out of these vouchers at the moment, I think, that money will all come at the expense of public schools, or will it come from the expense of other programs in the state budget?
So the larger and larger this voucher program gets, it's going to take away not just from public education, but other parts of our budget as well. So public education is the biggest expense that the state government pays for. And so whenever you drop the amount of revenue, which they're doing with their upside-down tax code, and they're trying to make it worse, and whenever you commit huge chunks of money to things that are not public education, it necessarily has to come out of the public education budget because that is the biggest thing and the most important thing that we fund.
Is there money if you took all of the money away from the public schools, shut them down, would there be enough money?
Don't give them ideas, Mike.
Well, would there be enough money to fully fund these scholarships with no detriment to the budget? And would there be enough private schools to take the students?
I have not done that calculation.
Okay.
I know there would not be enough private schools to take all the students, obviously, and they would, and the private schools would not take all the students because public schools are the ones that have to take every child, no matter where they are, whether they speak English, whether they have a learning disability, behavioral problems, no matter what their family finances are, no matter where they live in the state, and educate that child and meet that child where he or she is. Private schools don't have to do that. They can cherry pick their students and wouldn't want to be forced to take all students and are not forced to do so and therefore won't.
So we have 4 minutes left. You ran to be the insurance commissioner. I know that you were on the insurance committee in the Senate, so you probably know a little bit about insurance and how the state insurance commission runs. You were running with a vision for that department as one that valued transparency, accountability, and advocacy. It doesn't now.
No, it really doesn't. And what I found as I traveled the state is most voters have no idea that we elect a commissioner of insurance. They didn't know who the current commissioner of insurance is. They don't know anything about the guy. I did the best I could to point out all the scandals that he's been involved in, how badly he does the job, how many times he has raised our insurance rates that we have to pay in ways that are unfair and without any sort of public hearing to justify those rate hikes, how he relies on money from insurance company PACs to fund his campaigns and then turns around and gives them what they want, which is a rate hike. When people heard what I had to say, their eyes opened wide and said, "Holy cow, I had no idea." But we did not have the time or the money to be on television statewide to bring that message to everyone. And so now we are stuck with another 4 years of the current commissioner of insurance, and he knows he can get away with it. He's done it for 8 years, and he's going to do it another 4 years, unfortunately.
Rampant destruction from stronger, more numerous storms resulting from climate change are causing homeowner insurance rates in some areas to soar, including the fact that some insurance companies no longer insure any properties in certain areas. It's causing cancellations. According to the New York Times, our state has been regarded as one of the more stable for insurance, for both the insurance companies and for the ratepayers, and that our auto rates are among the lowest in the country. What more do you believe you could have done had you won?
Our auto rates have been among the lowest in the country for decades. So the incumbent can't take credit for that. And in fact, we have dropped. We used to be the most affordable in the whole country, and we've dropped already to seventh or something like that. And we're on the wrong trajectory there on auto rates for sure. Homeowners, we have been, people wouldn't believe it, but kind of lucky in that we haven't had any major hurricanes that caused reimbursable damage in North Carolina in a while compared to some of our other states. And we have a huge coastline. So we, in a lot of low-lying areas of our
There's
state.
Hurricane
So we,
Helene.
well, let's talk about that. Major damage in Western North Carolina from that, most of which is not insured loss. Because most people do not have flood insurance. It's one of the many issues I have with Mike Causey, the current commissioner of insurance, that he has not done more to encourage people in our state to get flood
I
insurance.
have a, I have
People
less than a
don't
minute.
get
I
it.
have less. I have less than a
Go
minute
ahead.
left. People have homeowners insurance. They have some have flood insurance. Some have wind damage insurance. But these are three different policies, and some people don't know that their homes through their homeowner insurance is not covered by wind or flood. Could we simplify that?
It's a market-based system, so no, we can't force the market to offer it all as one policy. But in a little bit of time I have, I want to encourage people to look into flood insurance because the damage that happened in Western North Carolina is largely not covered by homeowners insurance, and you don't want to be in that situation in
So
the future.
We have 10 seconds left. Senator Marcus, what's next for you?
Haven't decided yet. I want to find a way to contribute and use my experience. I'd love to see more women in elected office. I'd like to see more Democrats so we have a balanced government. And I look forward to a clean slate and some new opportunities. Thanks so much for having me.
Senator Natasha Marcus, Mecklenburg District 41. Thank you for being here.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.